I'll briefly describe the period. There were two kings during this period because of the prosperity, just had long reigns. In the south was Uzziah, and in the north was Jeroboam II, and they both reigned for almost this whole period of time. Uzziah 783 to 742, Jeroboam II 786 to 746, so they almost coincided with each other. And I mentioned this was a time of prosperity. It was a time of the absence of war. It was a time of great, and when there was not war, because they were on the great trading routes then between the great civilizations, they benefited from them, so they gained more and more wealth. And they established really great military power at this time, both the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom. It was also a time of when the fears of the anti-king people really came true. First of all, the worship of idols, the worship of Baal. And we won't spend a lot of time on that, but just to be somewhat sympathetic, the gods that they were tempted or seduced into worshiping were fertility gods and fertility goddesses. And if you were a farmer, you had all of the word from your surrounding neighbors that if you do not do the proper worship, then your crops will not succeed. So it was a seduction. It was like crop insurance. You would go to worship Yahweh, but then you would also have your household fertility gods and goddesses just in case. Now, did you ever think of that, to kind of maybe adopt every religion just in case? And that was a constant seduction away from the worship of Yahweh and only Yahweh. Coupled with that was gross economic injustice. And we know this during this time of prosperity. It was a time when the rich became richer and the poor became poorer. It was a time when the rich took advantage of the poor by taking their land away and adding land and more land until you had great plantation type of land holdings among the rich, and the poor then denied their rights. And we know this actually from archaeological data. You have the massive homes of the rich, beautifully decorated homes of the rich, and then the poor now really living in slum-like or hovels, situations of just... And the problem the poor had is that the covenant was supposed to be over all, and the judges, remember Moses established judges to assure that everyone lived under the covenant. So the poor would go to the judges, and in the scriptures they're called those who sit at the gate. Well, that was where judgments were made. And the rich paid off the judges with bribes. So the poor knew they had no chance at all. So you had the development of a sense of only Yahweh is our hope, because there is no earthly institution anymore that protects our rights. So see how far we've come now from the man of spirituality that was taught in the wilderness and the man of spirituality that's taught in the covenant. And now I'm going to just read page 5 from the little pamphlet here. Yahweh let the people have a king. However, what the opponents feared came true. The kings and their privileged associates gained more and more wealth and more power, and the shalom community, or the manna community, disintegrated. The nation divided into two parts, Judah to the south and Israel to the north. Both nations became Egypt-like societies where the kings and privileged classes accumulated and accumulated more land, more food, more power, more luxury items, all at the expense of the common people. Many ordinary people became landless and even destitute, with nowhere to turn for help. The judges who should have protected their rights were bribed by the rich. The wealthy accumulators forgot that all things belong to Yahweh and are gifts of Yahweh for the sustenance of the whole community. They thought they owned things. They thought now that they deserved things. And now the rich became managers of their excess rather than thankful receivers of God's blessing. Control replaced thankful receiving. Accumulation replaced sharing. Division replaced unity, and the manna community rotted, spread maggots, smelled to high heaven. Do you know where I got that metaphor?
Mm-hmm.
From the rotting manna. Now the community rots. And I think it was the vision of the original rotting manna is when people begin to be like this, then the society itself disintegrates. Now, it was in this time of crisis, now that we have the rise of the great prophets. Now, just as a very brief remembrance or reminder that when the Bible uses the word prophet, it is not primarily the way we use the word prophet, which is how do we use the
future.
Yeah, someone who foretells the future. They did talk about, if you do this, this will happen, or they did promise that God will do this, but primarily they were preachers to a particular people at a particular time, proclaiming the word of God to them there. So a prophet, if you want to put a little catchphrase that helps, prophets were first forth-tellers, and only secondly foretellers. They're first foretellers. Now we're going to hear from the prophets, and I'm not going to take the time to say exactly where each prophet and what situation they came into, but just think of it was during this time of the end of the reign of prosperity. The prophets saw these good times ending because the prophets saw history. And they saw the rise now of Assyria. And Assyria were known in the ancient world as really the cruelest people on earth. And now those people from Assyria are coming to power. And you get, this makes the Jonah story even more wondrous when it says the whole city of Nineveh repented. You're talking about what everybody in the ancient world would call the most cruel and ruthless and sadistic people on earth, that had no mercy at all when they conquered another people, who were known for their torture and for their slaughter. Now that nation is rising to power in the ancient world, and the prophets are saying the good times are over. And the prophets see this now as a judgment of God upon a people who are leaving the covenant, worshiping the fertility gods and goddesses, and practicing injustice in their relationship to the poor. Now let's just hear some of the words of the prophets, and I'll assign passages and read them like a preacher when you read it. Okay, you ready to do that? These come from different times and different decades and everything, and I'm not going to unravel that, but just to get a sense of it. Let's start with Karen. Isaiah 5, 8 through 13. And then Carolyn, Isaiah 10, 1 through 4. And Ezekiel 22, 6 through 12. Carol. And Sandy, Amos 2, 6 through 8. And Melanie, Amos 4, 1 through 3. And read Micah 2, 1 and 2. And then I'm going to add one. Linda, would you read Amos 8, 4 through 8? Hear the call now of the prophets, both the threats and the call of the prophets during this time. And I'll call on the passage, and if I think of any one, the first is Isaiah 5, and the first part of Isaiah is really during during the end times of the prosperous period in the south. Okay.
Woe to you who add house to house and join field to field, till no space is left and you live alone in the land. The Lord Almighty has declared in my hearing, surely the great houses will become desolate and fine mansions left without occupants. A 10-acre vineyard will produce only a bath of wine, a homer of seed only an ephah of grain. Woe to those who rise early in the morning to run after their drinks, who stay up late at night till they are inflamed with wine. They have harps and lyres at their banquets, tambourines and flutes and wine, but they have no regard for the deeds of the Lord, no respect for the work of his hands. Therefore my people will go into exile for lack of understanding. Their men of rank will die of hunger, and their masses will be parched with thirst.
People basically said, come on, God is kidding. We have the temple here, and we do the temple rituals, and God will never forsake us. You notice the, where do you see the manna accumulation in that passage? What are they doing?
House to house, field to field.
Which simply means driving poor people into becoming tenant farmers and becoming slaves and day laborers, and mostly probably unemployed or largely unemployed. Which means really to be finally driven into slavery. Wow. Okay, Isaiah 10, 1 through 4.
Woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees, to deprive the poor of their rights and rob my oppressed people of justice, making widows their prey and robbing the fatherless. What will you do on the day of reckoning when disaster comes from afar? To whom will you run for help? Where will you leave your riches? Nothing will remain but to cringe among the captives or fall among the slain. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised.
Again, they just said, you got to be kidding. We're in the midst of the great prosperity. You know, we're better off now than we were 4 years ago. How can you say that? Ezekiel 22. I don't know that much of it. I haven't studied Ezekiel. I know some parts of it are much later and some parts of it are earlier. And I think this is one of the earlier parts. But,
Behold, the princes of Israel and you, everyone according to his power, has been bent on shedding blood. Father and mother are treated with contempt in you. The sojourner suffers extortion in your midst. The fatherless and the widow are wronged in you. You have despised my holy things and profaned my Sabbath. There are men in you who slander to shed blood, and men in you who eat upon the mountains. Men commit lewdness in your midst. In you men uncover their father's nakedness. In you they humble women who are unclean in their impurity. One commits abomination with his neighbor's wife. Another lewdly defiles his daughter-in-law. Another in you defiles his sister, his father's daughter. In you men take bribes to shed blood. You take interest and increase and make gain of your neighbors by extortion. And you have forgotten me, says the Lord God.
Do you see the manna principles we're talking about in the covenant rule and how they're being shattered? And one we didn't get into was the rules of the deep respect for the marriage relationship. All that, no, it's just gone. You feel rotting manna. Notice who are the most vulnerable. We talk about the three most vulnerable people.
Foreigners.
Now, what are they doing to foreigners that have been extorting
them?
Yeah, extorting them, shortchanging them, taking advantage, getting their money away. The newcomer, the sojourner. My great
grandfather, when he came over from Sweden, got on the train in New York and he had a $50 bill, with all of his savings, and an apple seller came along and he didn't know anything, so he bought the apple, gave him the $50 bill, and the man said, "I'll come right back with your change." And never saw it, and he had to get to Iowa, so he was on the train, but he had nothing to eat, the whole trip, so he, but this is an example, this is what they're just all doing, the newcomer, the stranger, the foreigner, that is so vulnerable. I had a great aunt who also came from Sweden, was never seen. They know she got off the boat in New York and probably was sold into the white slave, or prostitution. Nobody ever heard from her again. Great, great aunt. Part of the family history of pain. But these are the vulnerable ones, and there were people there just waiting to make money, take advantage. That's the kind of society where they're. All the rich Israelites now, or actually, I forgot if Ezekiel's more to the north than the south, but the rich are stumbling over each other to take advantage of these poor, weak, foreign people that are traveling through the land and don't know the language and the system. Happy passages. Should we continue? Amos, now, Amos was a tree grower from the south, and his hometown was Tekoa. That's where we get our name Tekoa here at Holden Village, because it's where Amos came from, and he was called from being a dresser of trees from the south up to the northern kingdom to go up there and rail against the king and the false prophets and the false priests. And one of the most, one thing I'd like to assign and really encourage you to do this is just read the book of Amos so you get a sense of one prophet. And one of the funny parts in there is when the priest just tells him, "Get out of the country. And we don't want you here anymore. Go back to your trees." Let's just hear Isaiah as he talks about the life in the northern kingdom. Amos 2, 6 through 8.
This is what the Lord said. "For three sins of Israel, even for four, I will not turn back my wrath. They sell the righteous for silver, and the needy for a pair of sandals. They trample on the heads of the poor as upon the dust of the ground, and deny justice to the oppressed. Father and son use the same girl and so profane my holy name. They lie down beside every altar on garments taken in pledge. In the house of their God they drink wine taken as fines."
Now one of the, remember how we talked about the law and the spirituality was both mercy and compassion, or both righteousness and compassion. And there were just almost low humorous ways of having compassion. One was this, that if you loan money to a poor person, the collateral for that was the poor person's cloak. Well, the poor person needed that cloak at night because it's very warm in the day, but you need it at night because you'll get cold. So the rich person who had loaned the money, remember, of course, with no interest, but the rich person who had loaned the money was required to give the collateral back every night and then get it back in the morning. It was just one of those little beautiful ways of mercy. Now look at what they're doing. The men sleep on the clothing that they have taken from the poor as security for their debt. No mercy, no compassion. And here, so what you would have is a situation of poor people actually huddling together at night because they can't stay warm. One of the things that really struck me when we were in China, hearing about pre-revolution China in the remote villages, was what it was like to just have to take turns at night sharing blankets. You know, one thing we kind of take for granted, unless sometimes you're a guest at somebody's home and they don't give you enough blankets and you don't know where they are. I remember one night being a guest and I was in the hall with my hand going down the wall, trying to be quiet, hoping I'd run into the linen closet because I was so cold. You know, I knew that I'd find something or put that, I mean, to have absolutely nothing at night to stay warm. You know,
you find it.
That's okay. Amos 4, 1 through 3. Listen to what Amos says about the women of the northern kingdom. What they call them here.
Listen to this word, you cows of Bashan, living in the mountains of Samaria, oppressing the needy, crushing the poor, saying to your husbands, bring us something to drink. The Lord Yahweh swears this by his holiness. The days are coming to you now when you will be dragged out with hooks, and the very last of you with prongs. Out you will go, each by the nearest breach in the wall, to be driven all the way to Hermon. This is Yahweh who speaks.
I added Amos 8, 4 to 8. Just listen to this and remember what we talked about in the first session about ritual. Ritual and life being out. And have you ever been at a worship service and said, I can't wait till this is over?
Mm-hmm.
No. This is going on forever. I can't wait. Now listen how they're saying that at their worship service. I can't wait till and why can't they wait until it's over?
That buying and selling again.
Now who has
I have it?
Yeah.
Hear this, you who trample upon the needy and bring the poor of the land to an end, saying, when will the new moon be over that we may sell grain? And the Sabbath, that we may offer wheat for sale, that we may make the ephah small and the shekel great, and deal deceitfully with false balances, that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals, and sell the refuse of the wheat. The Lord has sworn by the pride of
justice. Isn't this amazing? They just can't wait till this festival is over so they can get back to their scales that they have manipulated, so they can take advantage. And then remember, before it went to the judges, you know, who are responsible to see that everybody is treated fairly, the judges have been bribed. Micah 2, 1 and 2.
I'm going to read this. Read.
Oh.
Woe to those who devise wickedness and work evil upon their beds. When the morning dawns, they perform it, because it is in the power of their hands. They covet fields and seize them, and houses and take them away. They oppress a man and his house, a man and his inheritance.
Yeah, it's the same theme, right? Just, you know, we could go on and on and on and on with these from the words of the prophets. See how they are blunt, aren't they, in saying exactly what's going on in the society. And it's social injustice, it's cheating the poor, it's taking advantage of the vulnerable, and it's finally disobeying God and breaking the marriage. It's breaking the marriage vow. And therefore, both that and the idolatry of worshiping other gods, the prophets finally call adultery. And leaving your true lover, Yahweh, and going to other gods. And now, sometimes we have been taught that the Old Testament is judgment and the New Testament is mercy. Have you ever heard that one?
Yeah, that's the way I was raised. The law is a mirror, what were the other words? And we never got into the Jews studied the law and were joyful about it, find pleasure, and we never got into what they found.
Listen to this from Hosea now. Does is there mercy and tender compassion of God, even at this time when everybody is cheating, adding land to land, idolatry, leaving God, forsaking the covenant, cheating the poor, bribing the judges. And then this is really the cry of God. It's Hosea 11, and the language is motherly, a very feminine language. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and I called my son out of Egypt. See the primal myth or the primal narrative. Out of Egypt, I called my little child. But the more I called to them, the further they went from me. They have offered sacrifices to the Baals and set their offerings smoking before the idols. It was I myself who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them in my arms. Oh, the picture here of a loving parent holding children in arms. Yet they have not understood that it was I who was the one looking after them. I led them with reins of compassion, or reins of kindness, with leading strings of love. I was like someone who lifts an infant close against her cheek. Stooping down to him, I gave him his food, manna. They will now have to go back to Egypt. Assyria must be their king because they have refused to return to me. The sword will rage through their towns, wiping out their children, glutting itself inside their fortresses. My people are diseased through their disloyalty. They call on Baal, but he does not cure them. Then just hear this pain. Ephraim, how could I part with you? Now, is God going to give these people up? Israel, how could I give you up? How could I treat you like Adma or deal with you like Zebulun? Evidently cities that have been totally destroyed and gone out of existence. My heart recoils from it. My whole being trembles at the thought. I will not give rein to my fierce anger. I will not destroy Ephraim again, for I am God and not man. I am the Holy One in your midst. I have no wish to destroy. God says that my mercy is so much stronger than my anger. Now, just one other passage that it probably comes out of a later time, but it also is just the merciful compassion of God. Isaiah 49, 14 and 15. For Zion was saying, Yahweh has abandoned us, the Lord has forgotten me. Does a woman forget her baby at the breast, or fail to cherish the son of her womb? And it goes back, remember, we use the metaphor that in Egypt God birthed these people, mothered them out of Egypt. And Isaiah says, God never, like a mother doesn't forget the baby at her breast. Child of her womb. What I'm going to give a quick review now of the history, just to show some of the things that were happening. And this is a part of the Bible I know the least about. I always in history got all confused with the different kings. Did you remember trying to study the kings and the royal family of England through the years and getting them all straight? And it's just a confusing array of kings that come marching on the scene. But we talked about the period of prosperity during the time of Uzziah and Jeroboam, and how quickly when Assyria started to rise, the northern kingdom says, we'll make a military alliance with Syria. Which was just worse, basically where Syria is today. We'll make an alliance with them. And as Assyria, not Syria, Assyria then just swept through and wiped them out. And then carried the people of Israel and deported them to cities throughout the Assyrian Empire. And then that is a part of the Hebrew people that just were no more. They just went off of the stage of history. And it was a common thing in those days, a common belief that the God of your conquerors were greater than your gods. So if you're conquered, you give up your gods and simply accept the God of your conqueror. And evidently that's what the people did. Except for a few who were left behind. And then the Assyrians were great population relocators, which tyrannies always do. Look what South Africa is doing now with its population. Well, Assyria was ruthlessly uprooting people and moving them to different areas of the empire. And they moved now people into what had been the boundary of the nation of Israel. And then the few Israelites who remained there intermarried with those people, kept most of their Yahweh religion and became what Jesus told stories about years later.
Samaritans.
So this now is a history of the Samaritans, who were hated by the Jews by the time of Jesus because they were half-breeds and they were heretics. But they maintained a form of Yahweh worship that lasts even to this day. There are Samaritans that live in the boundaries today of the nation of Israel. So how are we doing? Should we take a stretch? You want to? Because I'm going to go into some just reviewing history now, and we might need a
I'm going to do this thing here in about
4 hours. I'll follow you. I'm going to finally move up to a question that's relevant. That's where I'm moving. question that's relevant. When the Northern Kingdom fell, the Southern Kingdom, there was a mood of, oops. Now we better look at ourselves. So under the King Hezekiah, there was a brief period of reform that did not last very long. And also Hezekiah, against the advice of Isaiah, went to Egypt for help. And this P.O., is that the word to use? The Assyrians who swept through the country, swept through the land. And then the Southern Kingdom almost fell to Assyria. In fact, it was so critical that the king was there, Isaiah next to him, and the Assyrian armies were sieging Jerusalem itself. And then this, I hope I'm on the right king. Am I? I hope. And one of the great, it has to be one of the great celebrations of history. They were standing on the walls looking out, surrounded by the Assyrian armies. And one day they just watched the Assyrian armies simply pack up and go home. And later we found out that the Assyrian army both had plagues and terrible sickness in their armies, and also critical things that had to be dealt with in other parts of the empire, so they just left. And so now here's a period of relief, and the next king of Israel now promotes Assyrian religion, and actually we think Isaiah was martyred during his time, Manasseh. If we move all the way up to the period of 621, now the king is Josiah. who's remembered as a great king, and this is a time when the book of Deuteronomy is found, or the parts that eventually made the book of Deuteronomy. And the people and the king said, we must return to the covenant. We must follow the ways of the covenant. And there's a time of great national repentance and a turning under King Josiah. It's also the time now when Assyria is declining and Babylon is rising as a world power. And quickly Babylon overtakes Assyria. Now we're on this chart.
Okay.
We're on this chart where it has the Babylonian empire. And the dumb thing now that the kings of the south, now the only part that's left, the dumb thing they do is they start rebelling against Babylon. Because Babylon is demanding tribute from smaller nations now, as kind of like in the ghettos that happens today, that you pay off certain people so you don't get beat up. What is that called?
Extortion.
No, it's
protection.
Protection money.
Protection.
Yeah, so you were paying protection money to Babylon now, if you were a small nation like Judah. And the king does the dumb thing of withholding the money. And so here comes the Babylonian invasion, and now this time they are not lucky like they were. And there's a first invasion and a first deportation now to Babylon of all of the more professional people in the upper classes are taken to Babylon. Then there's 10 more years, and then the Babylonians set up a Judean person as a temporary king. And he revolts against Babylon, just politically dumb. And then Babylon just sweeps through and totally destroys Jerusalem and carries the king and the people into exile. And you read the story of the cruel thing of taking the king and then killing the king's sons right in his eyes and then poking his eyes out, so it was the last sight he saw, and then carrying him in chains to Babylon with the rest of the people, leaving some of the poorest people behind, including Jeremiah, the prophet, is left behind. But now we have the people in 587 going into the time of the Babylonian exile. And now, I can't... you know, if we had the time here to study exile, we can't begin to understand, I think, as an American, what it is like to be exiled. You'd have to go to refugee camps today. Maybe you could...
Bill, did you get to a refugee camp?
Mm-hmm. People that have been uprooted from their home. Maybe this was even different because not only being uprooted, everything in your home destroyed, and you're taken hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles. Many probably died on the way as the whole people now are deported to Babylon. And think of them now in Babylon. Everything that is precious is destroyed. Their temple, their city, everything that was dear, their farm, their city, their way of life, everything that's familiar, and now transferred and set in a totally strange land. We can't even begin. We had the story when I lived in New Mexico among the Navajos. It was called the Trail of Tears. When Kit Carson decided, or the United States government decided to move the entire Navajo Nation to eastern New Mexico. It's called the Trail of Tears because of the many who died on the way. When they got there, there wasn't enough sustenance in the land to support them, disease, famine, dying, and one of the merciful things that the United States government did in history was to let them finally go back, those who were still alive. And it's deep in the memory of the Navajo people is those years of tears and the Trail of Tears. It's in their art and their poetry and their stories, in their memory.
you have to hear that to begin to understand what exile was like for the people of Judah.
And we get a picture of the pain of the pain of exile when we read Psalm. Do you remember those?
137.
Yeah, you know, Psalm 137. Became one of the most beautiful songs in God's spell. Remember?
At the end, while the disciples are watching the crucifixion, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, it's a, yeah, when they sing, beside the waters of Babylon, we sat and wept at the memory of Zion. Zion is home. Leaving our harps, hanging our poplars there, or hanging on the poplars there. Remember in the song in Godspell, they were hanging on the trees, their harps. For we have been asked to sing to our captors, to entertain those who had carried us off. Can't you just sing them and say, let's hear some ethnic Judean music, wouldn't that be cute? I can get them all dressed up in their ethnic costumes. They can sing us the songs of Zion. And they say to us, sing some of the hymns of Zion. How could we sing Yahweh's hymns in a pagan country? O Jerusalem, if I forget you, may my right hand wither. May I never speak again if I forget you, if I do not count Jerusalem the greatest of my joys. And then this deep sense of angry cursing. Yahweh, remember what the sons of Edom did on the day of Jerusalem, how they sat down with her razor to the ground. Destructive daughter of Babel, a blessing on the man who treats you as you have treated us. A blessing on him who takes and dashes your babies against the rock. Is there a cry of anger and anguish that's more deep and intense than just a cry to God that it would be blessed that the babies of these people would be smashed? And we can't feel enough of the anger and now despair of the people.
Yeah, this psalm was came to our minds so much several years ago. We were in Babylon, and of course, which was destroyed, but that river is still there, and those poplars, and it just came to us so, the people crying out as they sat beside the river and wept. And then at the end of it, here where he says, happy is he who repays you, and then you see this destruction of Babylon. Now they receive that, were repaid in their own destruction.
How short it was, 600 to 539. One of the shortest brutal empires that ever existed. How short it was. Two things, exciting things that happened in exile. The people, you had this belief that you accepted the gods of your conquerors because they were more powerful than your God. Why didn't these people do that? I mentioned before we were at Holderness how some of the American Indians believed this, and that's why I did a photography project once in Arizona on an Apache, White Mountain Apache Reservation. Without knowing anything about this, I drove into the main town of the reservation, a large white clapboard Midwestern looking church in Arizona, and really out of place. And when I got close, it said Lutheran Church, and started asking and found out it's declined now, but before the Second World War, 80% of the Apaches were Wisconsin Synod Lutherans. And I asked, how did this ever happen? And the Apaches were the last to surrender to the United States armies, and they're very proud of that they were the last Indian nation to hold out against the onslaught of the American armies. And when they finally surrendered on the day of the signing of the surrender papers, an old German Wisconsin Synod Lutheran missionary came over the hill. And they believed that the God of your conqueror was the true and the stronger God. So they became Lutherans.
The white God.
What?
The white God.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it just happened, it was a German Lutheran missionary that kind of stumbled into the place at the right time, wrong time or right time. So it's an interesting story of how this ancient idea still prevailed today. Why didn't the people that went to Babylon adopt Marduk as their god? This is a miracle of history. And for some reason, God, as a faith statement, again raised up a wonderful, wonderful prophet, maybe one of the greatest preachers that the world has ever known. We don't even know his or her name. And scholars simply call him or her, probably a him, I suppose most preachers in were, Second Isaiah. And convinced these people, or at least part of them, that Yahweh, the God who had lost the war, as the world would say, actually was the God of all nations and had simply done this as a way of disciplining the people to remake them. And he showed them that what God had done was brought them back to Egypt again. And then what happens in Egypt? You're reborn. Reborn. You're reborn. You're born again. God will again birth a people out of another Egypt. And the wonder of this, which is, Trito. Okay, Second Isaiah, I'm sorry, yeah, Deuteronomy, Second Isaiah. Then we have a third Isaiah, which is Isaiah 56 to the end. And then in all parts of Isaiah, you have some sections that are lost and misplaced from other parts, but generally that's the case. Now, think of the words that are the opening lines in the Messiah. Handles Messiah into this situation of exile. Comfort, comfort ye my people, says your God. And the tenderness that must have been in the voice of this preacher when he spoke the word of God. No longer it is the old prophets who were crying out words of judgment, but it was a prophet saying, speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that her warfare is ended, that she has received now from Yahweh's hands double for all her sins. You've been more than punished. Now God comes again to save. And then he talks about this glorious day when the wilderness will blossom and the people will, there'll be a new exodus like out of Egypt. And we'll go home. And we're going to go home again. And then this prophet, Second Isaiah, he does something that bothers some of the people very, very much. He looks over to the nation of Persia and sees the rise of King Cyrus. And the only person that you have more glowing words about in the entire Bible than Cyrus are probably David, Abraham, and Jesus. Cyrus is the Savior. Cyrus is God's anointed Messiah, and the people, some of them, are just offended by this. He's a pagan.